LRS and Will Acheson do not provide any legal advice. Listeners to this podcast and visitors to the LRS website should consult with their own lawyer for legal advice. LRS is not a law firm, and our employees are not acting as your attorney. The information contained in this podcast and on LRS.com is general legal information and should not be construed as legal advice to be applied to any specific factual situation.
Hey, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, LRIS's monthly podcast about developments in public safety labor relations. I'm your host, Will Acheson, and I'll be spending the next 45 minutes or so with you going over things that have happened over the last month that may have some impact on labor relations and employee relations in your environment. But first, a little detail. How do you subscribe to this podcast? Well, the easiest way is to go to our webpage, LRIS.com. In the upper corner of the right corner of the webpage, you will see a link to the First Thursday podcast. Click on that link and you will see other links that will enable you to subscribe to the podcast through iTunes or whatever other service you may have. If you do subscribe to the podcast, it will come to you automatically every month. You won't have to go hunt and peck for the podcast. All right, let's start in on the month's developments. And I want to start in New Jersey, where there's an interesting decision out of a court of appeals in New Jersey about a cut in retirement benefits and what's known as the contracts clause. You're going to see a lot of litigation about this in upcoming years. As we have seen public safety retirement systems cut back retirement benefits, in some cases for existing employees, and in some cases even for retirees. And you will see a primary challenge to these cuts in benefits coming in the form of what's known as a contracts clause challenge. What's the contracts clause? Well, it's a usually very obscure provision in the United States Constitution, and these clauses exist, I think, in every other state constitution as well, not just the federal constitution. It's a clause that prohibits the government from passing any law that impairs the obligation of contract. Over the years, there have been a lot of different legal tests used for contracts clause cases, particularly when they concern cuts in either pension benefits or post-retirement health insurance benefits. But really today, I think it's safe to say that courts looking at these contracts clause cases ask three questions. First of all, is there a contract? Secondly, does the law impair the contract? And third, is that impairment substantial? And if you answer all three of those things with a yes, that there's a contract, the law impairs the contract, and the impairment is substantial, then courts will typically use some sort of balancing test to look at, on one hand, why it is that this impairment was created. Think of, for example, a cut in retirement benefits, versus, on the other hand, the degree to which the impairment impacts the contract rights of retirees or active employees. So, with that as a background, what was going on in New Jersey? Well, we have to go back to 2010 for this. Newly elected Governor Chris Christie was proposing a number of cuts to police and fire retirement plans, and in fact, the retirement plans of all public employees. You may recall that that was one of the campaign planks that Governor Christie ran on. He held a whole bunch of town hall forums where he was very aggressive in terms of stating his intent to cut pension plans, and then that became part of his legislative agenda once he was elected. There were three changes made by the legislature at the request of Governor Christie in 2010. And those three changes in New York were, first of all, a change that had very little directly to do with retirement. It simply limited the amount of vacation carryover you could have from year to year. Second change definitely impacted retirement. What it did was to use a new definition for final compensation, which is that figure upon which retirement benefits are calculated. It used a new figure. In the past, it had been the highest 12 months or the last 12 months of service, whatever your compensation was. And the new figure would be your highest 3 years of service. That, of course, would almost certainly produce a lower retirement benefit. The third change is the one we're interested in for purposes of this litigation, and it required all firefighters and officers to contribute 1.5% of base salary towards the cost of providing post-retirement health insurance benefits. And the way this statute was worded was that it wouldn't take effect immediately, rather it would take effect upon the expiration of an existing collective bargaining agreement. So as the collective bargaining agreements for Jersey City or Newark or Trenton or wherever it might be would expire, this 1.5% contribution would kick in. A group of unions, including police and fire unions in New Jersey, filed a lawsuit in state court saying, hey, this violates the contracts clause. Their argument was, look, we had a contract with you here. The contract was that we would provide our labor in exchange for a promise of these post-retirement benefits. Now you're imposing this 1.5% contribution. That changes the contract that we have with you. And the New Jersey Court of Appeals ends up rejecting that argument. And here's the court's analysis, and it's kind of an interesting analysis, and I think it actually begs the real question, but I'll get to that in just a moment. The court's analysis is this. Look, says the court, retirement, post-retirement health insurance, that's a mandatory subject for collective bargaining. And that means it can be created by contract and it can be taken away by contract. Now, what occurs when your contract expires is that the employer has an obligation under the state labor laws to maintain the status quo until a new contract expires. Nothing controversial about that. That's called the status quo doctrine. You find support for it in both federal and state labor law. And it's the whole idea that when a contract expires, an employer can't go reducing wages or reducing vacation or making any changes in mandatory subjects of bargaining. Rather, those changes have to occur through the bargaining process. So back to what the court is saying. The court is saying, look, when your contract expires, you don't have a contract anymore. Instead, what you have is a preservation of benefits by virtue of the status quo doctrine. And you know what? That is not a contract that is covered by the contracts clause. Here's the wording of the court. Contrary to the union's arguments, the status quo doctrine creates statutory, not contractual, prohibitions against a party changing the terms and conditions of employment during negotiations for a new contract. And because the legislature created the prohibitions on such changes, the legislature can modify them by statute. So in other words, we don't even have a contract here that we can analyze under the contracts clause, says the court. So why do I think that begs the question? Well, because what it doesn't do is to deal with the fact that while the unions may not have a contract, and in fact the court may be right that it's the operation of the state collective bargaining statute that creates the status quo doctrine, while the unions may not have a contract, what about that individual contract that individual employees had when they took their jobs? And that contract that said, we, meaning the employer, we're going to provide you with fully paid post-retirement health insurance with no contribution from you. What about that contract? That individual contract under which employees subsequently contributed their labor. I think the court failed to analyze whether or not there were individually held contract rights here as well as those held by the unions. And I would fully anticipate you'd see that issue litigated either later on in this case, if it's appealed, or in other litigation. Next up, I want to talk about an FLSA question. You may know that we've got a Q&A page on our website, and from time to time people send in questions, and I answer the questions, being very careful to say that my answers can't be relied upon by anybody because I'm not a lawyer in their state and I'm not their lawyer. But from time to time we get questions, and I take a shot at giving answers to them. It's an interesting question that came in this month from Louisiana that asked some basic questions about the FLSA, and I thought it would be worth talking about just a little bit in this month's podcast. So here's the question. In our law enforcement agency, all personnel assigned to law enforcement duties with arrest powers are deemed salary exempt under the FLSA, with only comp time awarded as overtime. The positions are further broken down into essential and non-essential personnel. Parenthetically, by the way, I've always bristled at the notion that somebody's job is non-essential. How would you feel, you know, being designated non-essential? I think we could come up with some other term for that, don't you? At any rate, back to the question. As an example, a patrol officer is deemed essential while a detective is deemed non-essential and is not required to work holidays but is compensated for the holidays. Both positions classified as deputy sheriffs on a 28-day salary pay scale. However, a detective is compensated for a salary at 160 hours, while a patrol officer is required to complete 168 hours of work before they can be paid the same salary. And here comes the question, is this practice sound? Does this practice violate the FLSA? And here's my answer. My answer is, first of all, there's a bunch of questions embedded in what seems to be a fairly simple question. So what we have to do is winnow apart the questions first. First, what about this use of comp time to compensate for overtime? Before we get back to the exempt issue and the two different overtime thresholds, what about this use of comp time? Everybody forced to accept comp time as compensation for FLSA overtime. And my answer to that is what the employer is doing here is probably okay. Comp time is controlled by Section 7-0 of the FLSA, if you're counting 29 United States Code Section 2070. And the way the Supreme Court has interpreted this in a decision that comes to us from Harris County, Texas, the way the Supreme Court has interpreted Section 7-0 is that while Section 7-0 requires that there be an agreement between employees and the employer with respect to the use of comp time as a substitute for cash compensation for overtime, in a non-union environment, says the court, that agreement can be imposed as a condition of employment. So, in other words, if this employer has done it right, what it could have said to all employees, could have put in its policy manual, is look, as a condition of working here, as a condition of working overtime, you must agree to accept comp time in lieu of cash compensation for overtime. And that would be acceptable under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Now, I know you may be thinking, well, wait a minute, doesn't the FLSA require an agreement? And isn't there an element of voluntariness to the word agreement? How can an employer impose that as a condition of employment? And my answer is, that's what the FLSA clearly seems to allow. There's Department of Labor rules on that that allow the employer to impose the agreement as a condition of employment. And if those are the rules, that's the way the law is. I understand that it may not be the way everybody else would use the word agreement. Just a few reminders, if you have an FLSA comp time system, that Section 7-0 has a whole bunch of other requirements. Comp time has to be accrued at the rate of 1.5 hours for each hour of FLSA overtime work. There's no such thing as straight time comp time under the FLSA. Comp time can't be forfeited under the FLSA. There's no such thing as use it or lose it comp time under the FLSA. An employer can pay employees for comp time, can cash employees out of comp time, but it cannot force them to either use it or lose it. A third requirement is that there are maximums, that the maximum amount of comp time you can have on the books at any one time. For sworn employees, they're 480 hours. For non-sworn, it's 240. And lastly, under the FLSA, comp time has to be paid in cash at the employee's then current regular rate of pay on the employee's retirement or other termination from employment. So if you earn comp time when you were making $20 an hour, and by the time you retire and you've got 100 hours of comp time on the books, you're making $30 an hour, well, then the comp time gets cashed out at the $30 an hour rate. And it has to be, again, at the regular rate of pay, not simply the hourly rate of pay. So that's the first thing buried in this question. Is the comp time system this employer using legal? And my answer is very qualifiedly, because we don't know everything about it, probably. It sounds like it is. The second thing that's probably going on here is that the employer has probably established what's known as a Section 7K exemption for these employees. The FLSA, Section 207K of the FLSA, allows an employer of firefighters or law enforcement personnel to adopt a work period as the basic unit of measurement for overtime under the FLSA, rather than the work week that all other employees are on. And a work period can be between 7 and 28 days in length, and the overtime thresholds are higher than they would be for regular employees. So, for example, the 7-day overtime work period threshold for law enforcement is not 40 hours that you'd see for everybody else under the FLSA, not 40 hours in a week, it's 43 hours. And for firefighters, the 7-day threshold is 53 hours. And there's proportionate thresholds when you go up in length in the 28-day work period. For law enforcement, the most common work period you see under the FLSA is 28 days, and that overtime threshold is 171 hours in the 28-day period. Looking at the question, where it says that patrol officers have to complete 168 hours of work before they get any sort of overtime compensation, and detectives get it at 160 hours, what do I read into that? I read into that that the employer has probably established a 28-day Section 7K overtime threshold of 171 hours. And there would be nothing in the FLSA that would be violated by paying detectives for overtime when they work hour number 161, but not paying patrol officers until they work hour number 169. Both of that would be permitted, assuming the employer adopted the Section 7K exemption. The third thing in this question is what was explicit in the question, which is that these employees are treated as exempt salary employees under the FLSA. And here's where this employer may have been going wrong, or perhaps the nomenclature used in the question is a little bit off. The only exemptions, full exemptions, for employees under the FLSA that apply in this sort of setting are found in yet another section of the FLSA, Section 213A of the FLSA. And in this section, employees who are executive, professional, or administrative employees, as those terms are defined under the FLSA, are exempt from any overtime compensation, provided that they are salaried. The problem here is that this question says that detectives and patrol officers are treated as exempt, even though they have day-to-day enforcement duties, day-to-day crime investigation duties. That's not permitted under the FLSA. There were a section of, or a whole broad section of rules pertaining to public safety employees and the Section 213A exemption that were enacted by the Department of Labor almost 10 years ago. These were called the Fair Pay Regulations. And a good summary of those rules is that if you are performing line duties, meaning if you're a firefighter and you're engaged in suppression or inspection activities, or if you're a law enforcement officer and you're engaging in investigatory or arrest activities and the like, if you're performing line duties, you're not exempt as an executive professional or administrative person. You're not exempt no matter what your rank is. Even if you are a captain and you are performing line duties, you're out there, say you're a police captain and you're making arrests, you're entitled to overtime under the FLSA. There's a case out of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals called Mullins versus City of New York that stands for that proposition. So here where the question says, look, all of these employees are treated as FLSA exempt because they're salaried, well, that would be wrong if in fact that is occurring. The only people who could be exempt would be those without line in law enforcement duties who had duties that fell within those categories of administrative, executive, or professional. So, what seems like a simple question, as usual, may have several tiers of questions in it that turn out to be a little bit more complicated. While I'm on the FLSA, I want to get you an FLSA-like issue. It's not really an FLSA issue, but an FLSA-like issue. You know, one of the things an employer has to do under the Fair Labor Standards Act is to control the work of employees. There's a rule under the FLSA that if an employer either orders an employee to do work or suffers or permits the employee to work, then the employer has to compensate the employee for the work. It's called the suffers and permits rule. And what the Department of Labor has told us is that employers, look, if you don't want employees engaged in work, you have to use your administrative authority to prevent them from working. Otherwise, you're going to have to pay them. And it may mean, employers, that from time to time, you actually have to discipline employees who are performing work that you don't want employed. Well, this case that I want to talk to you about is it's another decision out of the New Jersey Court of Appeals. This one came down in late January of 2014. Another decision, and this one deals with an employer that did precisely that. It disciplined, in this case, a law enforcement officer for doing work that it didn't want the officer to perform. This is a case involving Sergeant George Foss, who works for the township of Pennsauken, New Jersey. And in 2010, when the township was in the middle of some economic difficulties, the township in Foss's union, which is Lodge 3 of the Fraternal Order of Police, entered into an agreement that said that all employees would have 4 furlough days for the rest of the year, September 4th, October 4th, and then days in November and December. And that was an agreement that was ratified. And all employees, including Sergeant Foss, were notified of these furlough days. His first furlough day was September 4th. He showed up for duty. And that confuses everybody to start with. The department hadn't been told by HR, what do you do if an officer comes to work on their furlough day? So the way the chief solves that is to talk to Foss and to say, Foss, okay, you can work this shift, but don't you do it again. And if you do, we'll discipline you. And then the chief also issues a memo informing all officers that if any officer reported for work on a furlough day, they wouldn't be paid for that day. And then he issues another memo saying, look, if you show up to work on a furlough day, you may face disciplinary action. You know this where this is going, right? October 4th is Foss's second furlough day. He shows up for work at 7 p.m. The chief immediately reports to the department and talks with Foss. And Foss says, and this is a quote, he wasn't purposely violating any order or being insubordinate. He just didn't agree with the FOP's stance on the implementation of furlough days. Well, eventually, the chief says, Foss, I'm not going to order you out of headquarters because you have a right to be here. I'm not going to let you work. I'm not going to give you any duties, and you're not going to be paid for that day. And then the city imposes a four-day suspension on Foss. Court of Appeals upholds that suspension. Basically says, look, an employer has the right to order employees not to work. Here's what the court says. We recognize the importance of maintaining discipline within the paramilitary organization of a police department. Refusal to obey orders and disrespect cannot be tolerated. As long as one remains a member of the police department, he must comport himself properly and not do anything that impairs the morale and discipline of the police department. Foss intentionally violated the chief's directive. And as a result, because this was an act of insubordination, the court says 4 days suspension is upheld. I want to switch over to a different issue, but still a disciplinary issue right now. This one comes out of Ohio. And actually, this case involves something that I don't think is as well understood about the Loudermill due process doctrine. Not as well understood as it could be. Everybody thinks of Loudermill as requiring a pre-disciplinary hearing. But what if the employer grants the employee a full post-disciplinary hearing? Say the employee has the right to binding arbitration, either individually or through the employee's labor organization, or say the employee has a full-fledged civil service appeal. Does the existence of the post-disciplinary hearing negate the employer's obligation to provide a pre-disciplinary hearing? And a lot of people will answer that question yes. If you have a full post-disciplinary hearing, no need for a pre-disciplinary hearing. In fact, I've seen some courts answer that question yes. But you know what? The answer is really no. And in fact, you can find the seeds of that answer in the Loudermill case itself. This is a case that involves a fellow named Jason Gross, who's a police officer with the village of Minerva Park, Ohio. This is a small town, and some of the facts here sort of have the tinge of small town politics. The village mayor concludes on July 18, 2011, that Gross had misrepresented department policy to other organizations. The court opinion doesn't really tell us what he did, but it's kind of an interesting charge. And based on a recommendation from the police chief, the mayor fires Gross. The mayor didn't offer Gross a pre-disciplinary hearing. And in fact, the first that Gross learned that he was going to be terminated or that there were charges against him was his termination letter. Gross hires a lawyer, gave notice of his intent to appeal his termination, and the village responds by saying something like, whoops, and puts Gross on paid administrative leave with pay and benefits back to his termination date pending the appeal. And then there's a lot of banter between the lawyers as to whether or not the mayor's decision was in fact a termination or whether it was a recommendation to terminate. Nobody ends up appealing on that or agreeing on that, and eventually Gross appeals whatever it was that happened initially to the city council or the village council. The council reduces Gross's termination to a 3-day suspension. Gross then sues the city in federal court, later on, the chief, while the federal court lawsuit is pending, again recommends that Gross be fired, this time for a continued pattern of incompetence, neglect of duty, and failure to obey orders. Gross's letter requests a pre-disciplinary hearing on this second charge. The village responds the next morning with the documents and says that the mayor was not required to give Gross a pre-disciplinary hearing, but offers a meeting with the mayor at 6:15 p.m. that same day, or between 7:30 a.m. and 10 a.m. the next day. Gross's lawyer says, hey, I'm not available on that short notice. And the mayor responds by terminating Gross. So then this litigation moves on forward, challenging this combination of two terminations. And this is a preliminary court ruling on some of the legal issues. And the legal issue that the court wanted to focus on here was the first termination and whether or not the city, the village, had to give Gross a pre-disciplinary hearing in light of the fact that he had this right to a full hearing before the council and indeed actually had the hearing and won because his termination was converted to a suspension. And the federal court that's considering the case, it's a trial court, says Gross's due process rights were violated. Why? Because actually, in Loudermill itself, this is the case that says you've got to have a pre-disciplinary hearing. Due process requires it. In Loudermill itself, the employee who was being disciplined had a post-termination remedy. That employee had the right to go to arbitration, if memory serves me correct. And the Supreme Court nonetheless said, you need to have a pre-disciplinary hearing. And here's the rationale behind that. The court says, look, Loudermill says that the root requirement of the Due Process Clause is that an individual has to be given an opportunity for a hearing before they're deprived of a property interest. Dismissals for cause will often involve factual disputes, and even where the facts are clear, the appropriateness or necessity for termination may not be. And in those cases, the only meaningful opportunity to invoke the discretion of the decision maker is before the termination takes effect. And in the words of the court, it's too late to present one side of the story once the decision maker has already announced a decision. If the constitutional guarantee of due process is to be respected, the person has to be able to present their side of the story before the decision is rendered. I want to move over now to a couple of workers' comp cases. Both of these, I think, illustrate difficulties that public safety employees have with respect to making certain types of workers' compensation claims. The first one is a stress claim. It comes out of New York, and it involves an officer by the name of James Cook, who worked for the East Greenbush, New York Police Department. In 2009, Cook was called to the scene of an incident that involved an armed suspect firing shots at passing motorists and eventually at law enforcement officers. Cook and a couple of other officers were assigned to be on the contact team, which approached the shooter from behind. Cook was the spotter, and the other officers end up shooting and killing the suspect. And with Cook, of course, playing an integral role since he is the spotter. A year later, Cook begins to miss work on a regular basis and shows up with all sorts of stress-related conditions. He is officially diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder related to the shooting. He files an application for workers' comp benefits, which the city denies. And then Cook appeals the denial through the court system. So that's the situation that the appellate court has to decide. Courts around the country apply different standards when they're taking a look at stress claims. And I think of there as being essentially three standards that are out there. And you can have check your state to see which one applies in your jurisdiction. One standard, which is the easiest one for public safety employees to be able to meet, one standard simply asks, look, was this a condition caused by an on-the-job incident? And if it was, then it's going to be compensable, just like any other workers' comp claim, say these states. You know, you don't ask any other questions about a broken leg other than did it happen on duty. Why should you treat PTSD any differently? A second standard, which is the toughest standard to meet, requires that stress claims be produced by an incident that also resulted in physical injury to the employee. So in other words, it's not enough that you were exposed to something that caused PTSD. Instead, in that incident that exposed you to whatever it was that produced the PTSD, you also had to be hurt, physically hurt. So it might be something like a car accident, or maybe it would be a shooting where you in fact were shot. Those states make it almost impossible, of course, to produce stress claims. New York is in the middle category, the third category, but in between those two standards I just described. And in New York, the threshold is whether the stress experienced by the employee is more than is normally encountered in the same job. So you look at what it is the normal duties of a firefighter, police officer, corrections officer might be, and you look at whether or not this event that caused the stress, whether or not this event was somehow beyond normal. And in Cook's case in New York, the court says, look, we are going to uphold the Workers' Comp Board's decision that what Cook encountered is not beyond the norm. The court says here, although Cook's supervisor described the particular circumstances of this encounter as extraordinary in the regular course of duty for a police officer, no matter what the size of the department, it's extraordinary, said this supervisor, to be involved in the situation where you're a spotter where somebody else ends up getting killed. Nonetheless, all police officers are put on notice each day that deadly force may be required to subdue a suspect who is endangering public safety. Therefore, being part of a team that shoots and kills a suspect, that's normal for a police officer, says the court. And because it's normal, Cook can't bring a claim for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now look, the standards for PTSD, the national standards for PTSD, actually are in some ways getting easier to prove. You may be aware of the fact that under the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act and the EEOC's regulations under the ADAAA, PTSD is presumed to be a disability. That evolution hasn't leaked into the standards for adjudicating stress claims under workers' compensation laws. If you're in a state that has either this physical injury requirement or the normal stress encountered by an employee requirement, and you want that changed, I think what the Cook case is telling you is the way it has to be changed is through legislation, not through litigation. State legislatures can create and modify workers' comp laws, and that will be where the standards for adjudicating stress claims will have to be changed. And while we're talking unusual workers' compensation rules, I'd be negligent if I didn't tell you about a case coming out of, again, New Jersey this time. This one only came out, third week in February, I think, of 2014. I'd be negligent if I didn't tell you about this and suggest that you check the standards in your state with respect to this. What does the case involve? It involves a police officer who is on duty during his meal period where he's injured. Are you entitled to compensation, workers' compensation, when you're injured during an on-duty meal? Most courts, most states would say, sure, if you're on duty, you know, that's the end of the analysis. Not so in New Jersey, and not so in some other states. These states have a standard that is called the premises rule. And here's the way it ends up getting phrased usually, is that you are only entitled to a particular type of workers' compensation benefit. In this case, it's called under New Jersey law, accidental disability benefits. You're only entitled to it if you are on the employer's premises for the purposes of doing your duty. And if you're not on the employer's premises, then you're not going to get this level or maybe even any workers' compensation benefits. Well, this case involves a police officer named George Polizia, believe it or not, or Polizia, excuse me, I probably mispronounced that, who worked for Harrison Township, New Jersey. He was on duty, in uniform, got his radio with him. He met an off-duty police officer for lunch at a local pizzeria. And after having lunch, and while he was returning to his police car, he slipped and fell on a snow and ice-covered stairway. He applied for accidental disability retirement benefits, and he was turned down. And that's the case that makes it to the appeals court. The appeals court says, look, we got a premises rule here in New Jersey. And so what we have to look at is Polizia on the employer's premises? And the court says he wasn't. He said, the court says Polizia suffered the traumatic event off premises while descending an icy stairway and having a personal lunch with an off-duty colleague. He was therefore neither on premises, property owned or controlled by his employer, nor performing an activity preparatory to or essential to his actual duties at the time he sustained his injuries. On the contrary, he was returning to his patrol car, parked in a private parking lot, and enjoying an off-duty lunch break with his friend. Polizia says, wait a minute, I'm on uniform. That's a requirement that I be on uniform. I'm required to monitor my radio for assignments. Doesn't that mean that I am essentially on premises? And the court says, nope, it doesn't. The fact that a police officer may be considered always on duty doesn't mean that every accident occurs during the course of their duties. The fact is here, says the court, Polizia was off duty. So, once again, a bit of advice. If you've got a premises rule in your jurisdiction, that might make injuries suffered during paid meal periods, or for firefighters, injuries suffered during paid sleep period, might make those things non-compensable. The way to get those rules changed is not going to be through litigation, but rather through legislation. I want to close with a case that illustrates some practical advice that I've given to my clients for many, many years. I'm not sure I ever have talked much about my background here. I've, in addition to doing the teaching that we do through labor relations information systems and writing books about public safety labor relations, I have been a labor advocate. I've been a union side lawyer for well over 30 years and advised officers, firefighters on disciplinary cases hundreds and hundreds of times. And the practical advice that I have given employees time and time again is that the two most powerful words that they can use in the disciplinary process are, I'm sorry. And maybe there are three additional words that would be right below it, which would be, I screwed up. And I want to give you a case from Pennsylvania. I want to close this podcast with this case. give you a case from Pennsylvania that I think illustrates why I give that advice, and this is a corrections officer who either didn't get or didn't take that advice. This is a fellow, and I certainly will mispronounce his name, it's Samuel Remarowitz, who is a corrections officer for the state of Pennsylvania correctional institution in Pittsburgh. Remarowitz gets into a beef with a prisoner. There's an unruly prisoner, and several corrections officers are there and trying to deal with him. The prisoner's acting up like seriously. He's he's doing things like urinating onto the floor and spitting and kicking and all sorts of things. He kicks at the bottom of a cage until it gets bent outwards and he's able to crawl out of the opening. Well, eventually, a bunch of corrections officers show up. They're able to subdue the suspect, and apparently after he was subdued, Remarowitz actually kicks him in the face. The Department of Correction institutes an investigation, determines that Remarowitz has used excessive force and terminates him. It was a pretty serious kick, and there was some question about Remarowitz's behavior during the course of subduing the suspect as well. Remarowitz appeals his discipline, and his argument is essentially a disparate treatment argument. What he does is to say, look, there are three cases out there where corrections officers were found guilty of using excessive force against an inmate. They were in my same classification, these corrections officers, and yet each one received only a 5 or 10 day suspension rather than termination. The court says, not interested in that argument. Why? I'm going to read you about three sentences here that will tell you why the court rejected this claim and upheld the termination. The court says, Remarowitz's behavior was more, not less egregious than the behavior of the other three corrections officers. Remarowitz's behavior was brutal. And wait for it. Unlike the employees in those cases, Remarowitz's refused to acknowledge his wrongdoing. As a major credibly testified, Remarowitz's actions and, wait for it, his failure to admit wrongdoing warranted termination because Remarowitz, wait for it, doesn't think he's wrong. His thinking is not in line with our policy. The court says, look, we've held that violation of the Department of Corrections Code of Ethics, which constitute a dereliction of duty, are sufficient to establish just cause for termination, and it's present here. Does this case come out differently if Remarowitz says, I screwed up, I'm sorry? I don't know. I mean, he did engage in a very brutal act in kicking somebody in the face, kicking someone who was under control in the face. But I'll tell you what, he had no chance unless he used those magic words, I'm sorry. Absolutely no chance. No chance with his employer, and no chance, as you'll see, with the court. That's it for this month. I thank you for bearing with me. I have a head cold that won't stop going, unfortunately. And we look forward to seeing you at our next seminar. Our next seminar will be in April. It'll be in Las Vegas on collective bargaining with a bit of a focus on bargaining in hard times for public safety organizations and public safety labor unions. And if we don't see you at that seminar, we'll hope to talk to you again for next month's First Thursday. Thanks.